Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. It was still dark at Indian Dunes when Frank Marshall left. He had been there for the filming of the big climactic scene, the one director John Landis had promised would be huge. Marshall was the highest-ranking person on set, the executive producer with the most at stake and the most to lose, Spielberg's producing partner, the man Warner Brothers expected to make sure things went smoothly. He had watched the scene unfold. He had been standing close enough to understand, in that first terrible moment, exactly what had happened. And then, according to accounts that would emerge years later, he walked into the shallow water, pulled 6-year-old Renee Chen's crushed body from beneath its surface, and placed her on the shore. And then he walked to his car and drove away. If you listened to part one of this two-parter, you know that by the time the sun came up on July 23, 1982, three people were dead. Renee, 7-year-old Mika Lee, and 53-year-old actor Vic Morrow. The Santa Clara River Wash at Indian Dunes quickly became a crime scene, but before it made that shift, several people quietly left. Marshall was the most noteworthy because by departing when he did, he managed to avoid being interviewed by police and prosecutors, a move that insulated not just him, but also the rest of Amblin Entertainment and, most crucially, Steven Spielberg. Soon, law enforcement was on site trying to account for who had been present, what they had witnessed, and where they had gone. Elsewhere, in the machinery of Hollywood, a very different kind of conversation was beginning. See, Warner Brothers had a problem, several problems actually, and they knew it. They had a production that was only a quarter of the way through filming that was now inseparable from the deaths of an adult actor and two children. They had those children's illegal hiring to contend with, the middle of the night shoot, the parents paid in cash, the permits that had never been pulled, the firefighter-slash-child welfare officer who had been kept in the dark about the kids being on the set. They had questions, large and growing, about who knew what, and they had Spielberg's name on the poster. The studio convened. The decisions they made in those first days would shape everything that followed. Some decisions were practical. The film had the first segment in the can, despite the night's grisly turn, but it still had three others to finish, the ones directed by Spielberg, Joe Dante, and George Miller. They could shut the whole thing down, but that would mean eating the $1 million already spent on Landis's segment. Movie studios don't like wasting money. They also immediately knew they'd be facing monster legal bills and wrongful death lawsuits, so pulling the plug on the movie would just mean they had less coming in to help cover those costs. So the calculus began, and they decided to finish it, release it, and hope the name recognition carried it past the horrific press. The movie eventually did open in June 1983, nearly a year after the deaths, to mixed reviews and muted box office success. Critics noticed that something overshadowed the whole enterprise. One segment, in particular, was now impossible to watch the way it was meant to be watched. Other decisions were less visible, but more consequential. Warner Brothers began positioning. Steven Spielberg, who had not been at Indian Dunes that night, who had not ordered the children onto the set, and who it doesn't seem had any reason to have personally known that Landis planned to hire kids without a permit, was nonetheless the name that would make or break this film financially. and he'd been making movie studios millions upon millions of dollars. Keeping his reputation clean was a studio priority. To that end, Frank Marshall, per accounts pieced together from testimony and reporting over the years, apparently became very interested in being anywhere investigators were not. He spent years after the crash traveling internationally, scouting locations, technically, for Spielberg's projects. What he was less technically doing was being available for legal service. A subpoena requires the subject to be findable. Marshall had made himself quite difficult to find. That's why the trial in July 1983 was about five men: Landis, associate producer George Folsey Jr., unit production manager Dan Allingham, special effects coordinator Paul Stewart, and pilot Dorsey Wingo. Though tried together, they each had their own high-ticket lawyers as jurors tried to make sense of what happened on the ground at Indian Dunes. Who gave what order, who heard what warning, and who bore what responsibility for the specific chain of events that brought a helicopter down onto three people. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Lumi Gummies. I like edibles, but sometimes they get me way too high. But Lumi Gummies always make me feel just right. Consistent, mellow, and super delicious, Lumi Gummies are specifically designed to make you feel good, not stoned. Whether you're looking for an end-of-day de-stressor, a midday mood boost, or help getting the best sleep ever, Lumi Gummies has a strain that's right for you. They also come in 1 milligram or 5 milligram gummies, so you can get the exact dose you're looking for.
That's the part I love hearing about, the control over the dose.
And having that 1 milligram option means you're not committing to more than you want. I'll grab an orange cream cookies sativa for when I need to focus, or an indica when I just want to melt into the couch after a long day.
So there's a different strain for different moods.
9 strains across 3 effect categories: sativa, hybrid, and indica. Something for pretty much any moment.
Lumi Gummies are available nationwide. Go to LumiGummies.com, that's LumiGummies.com, and use code COTC for 30% off your order. Again, that's LumiGummies.com, code COTC, LumiGummies.com, code COTC.
People outside of Hollywood surely didn't know how much was happening in the investigation into the Twilight Zone crash. Newspapers reported on it, sure, but there was no social media back then. What the average person likely knew was that there had been an accident, and gee, isn't that tragic? People paying closer attention might have noticed how John Landis conducted himself in the immediate aftermath. He attended all 3 of the victims' funerals. He hadn't been invited to speak at Vic Morrow's, but he did anyway. It read, in part, quote, "Just before the last take, Vic took me aside to thank me for this opportunity. He knew how wonderful his performance was and wanted me to know how happy he was with the work. Tragedy strikes in an instant, but film is immortal. Perhaps we can take some solace in the knowledge that through his work in stage, television, and film, Vic lives on forever." End quote. Make of that what you will. Landis also attended, uninvited, the funerals of Mika and Renee. His presence was upsetting to many. While Morrow may have been expected to understand the risks associated with the on-screen stunts, Mika and Renee's parents had no reason to. It was immediately clear, too, that both parents on set believed Landis killed their children. Renee's mother literally shrieked, "You killed my daughter," at the crash site, her wails echoing off the canyon cliffs. At the funeral, she cried, "She was the only child I had. Now she is gone." I'll note here that an Associated Press photo was published alongside the wire service's coverage of that funeral. The picture wasn't of Renee or of her family, but of John Landis with his wife at her casket. While Renee wasn't actually Vietnamese, despite being cast as one, she was Taiwanese, Mika's parents had fled Saigon just before its fall. And they had literally fled the country to keep Mika safe from war, and instead he had died in a simulated Vietnamese village during a fake war scene. To get to the bottom of why and how that happened, the investigations began. The first entity to start was the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB. Now, its job isn't to assign blame in a courtroom sense, but rather to determine cause, to answer, as technically and precisely as possible, what went wrong and why. To most people, the cause seemed pretty obvious. The explosions of the huts along the shoreline had launched debris into the helicopter's rear rotor, throwing it off balance and causing the pilot to lose control. But Don Urente of the NTSB had to set that assumption aside and conduct dozens of interviews to make sure the true cause was uncovered. For his investigation, he'd coordinate with Sheriff Deputy Tom Buds and the Federal Aviation Administration, or the FAA. It's worth noting here that Urente got more cooperation from a lot of people involved in the shoot than police or prosecutors would. According to Steve Chain's book on the case, that was largely to keep Landis and crew from being ripped apart in the press. Now, the first draft of the NTSB report wouldn't be released for a year and a half. Before then, a lot of things happened, like the movie was finished and released. Most reviewers tried to separate out the real-life tragedy from their take on the film, but as Roger Ebert wrote, quote, "Because we know that Mara was killed in a helicopter accident during the filming of the segment, an additional pall hangs over the whole story," end quote. Actually, the review that sticks with me the most is one I found in the Cleveland Plain Dealer headlined, "Three of four, not bad for Twilight Zone remake." The weak link, wrote Donna Chernin, was the first, Morrow's timeout segment. It was too heavy-handed in its moralizing, she said. The idea that three people died not just for a movie, but for a mediocre part in a movie? Ugh, it just breaks your heart. Also, Vic Morrow's daughters reached a settlement with Warner Brothers and 19 other defendants before that NTSB report came out. That settlement was reached in late 1983, and though its terms were undisclosed at the time, Chain reported that Carrie Morrow and Jennifer Jason Leigh got $840,000. They would split it over time. An interesting aside, without this settlement, Jason Leigh would have gotten only what her father left her in his will, which was a paltry $100. The two were estranged when he died, and he left everything to his older daughter, Carrie, outside of that symbolic FUC note. As part of the settlement, neither daughter was to, quote, "in any way participate in or contribute to any public discussion about the accident," end quote, nor, and this part struck me as really weird, quote, "contribute to other publicity concerning or in any way relating to the personal relationships between and among plaintiffs and their father, Vic Morrow," end quote. So they couldn't talk about their relationship with their dad? Seems odd. Now, this was a definite win for Warner Brothers because a trial involving daughters, I mean, especially Jennifer Jason Leigh, who had just starred in Fast Times at Ridgemont High and was getting more famous by the day, would have been very bad press indeed. The NTSB released its initial report about 3 months after the settlement in March 1984. The probable cause, the board concluded, was the detonation of debris-laden, high-temperature, special effects explosions too close to a low-flying helicopter. It put the chopper at just 25 feet off the ground. The blast caused foreign object damage to one rotor blade and heat delamination to another. And that latter point was tough for me to visualize, but basically the rotor blade was built in layers, bonded together with adhesive. The report said that the explosion caused that adhesive to get so hot that the outer skin separated from the blade underneath. In short, the tail rotor assembly separated. The helicopter came down. The proximity of the helicopter to the explosions, the NTSB found, was the result of a failure to establish direct communication and coordination between Dorsey Wingo, who was in command of the helicopter, and Landis, who was in charge of the filming operation. The board also noted, in its formal findings, that the director had not conducted a pre-production meeting with the key personnel involved in a known hazardous operation to ensure the safety of people on the set. A federal agency and an official report saying John Landis failed a basic professional obligation. Landis's attorneys weren't having it. They petitioned the NTSB to reconsider, arguing that the crash was caused solely by heat delamination from a defective explosion and that the responsibility therefore rested entirely with the licensed pyrotechnics operator, not with the director. The board ultimately granted the petition in part, and its revised October 1984 report, its final one, it added delamination as a contributing factor alongside the debris impact, but it explicitly rejected the argument that the director's responsibility could be delegated to the man holding the detonator. Now, this is a bit in the weeds, yes, but I include it because it was a preview of an argument Landis's lawyers would present at trial. It wasn't Landis's fault. It was the pyrotechnic operator's fault. Landis, Fulzy, Allingham, Stewart, and Wingo were indicted in 1983 and ordered to stand trial in 1984 on charges of involuntary manslaughter. It, of course, was huge news.
John Landis went to court today to face a grim distinction, the first director ever charged with the deaths of actors in his own film. Today's indictments charge Landis and four others who worked on the film with killing the actors by failing to exercise the proper caution.
Because of his direction, we're alleging that the stunts were conducted in a reckless manner.
That last voice was the initial prosecutor in the case. Next is the judge and the director.
Landis, are you prepared at this time to enter your plea to counts 1 through 5 and each of them?
Yes, sir.
And what is your plea, sir?
Not guilty.
Once the NTSB report was finished, Don Urente had no reason to stay invested in the case. But he did, behind the scenes, according to Chain's book. He had been disturbed by what he had learned through his witness interviews. For example, a few hours before the 2:20 a.m. fatal shoot, at around 11:30 p.m., another scene had been shot. Dubbed the Rage Scene, it involved Vic Morrow screaming at the helicopter as he realizes that they think he's Viet Cong and are readying to shoot him down. It was the first scene shot with the chopper overhead, piloted by Dorsey Wingo. Now, Wingo had plenty of experience as a pilot, but not as one doing stunt work in Hollywood. He had been hired by UPM Allingham because he was the cheapest of the three Allingham interviewed. The other two, who would have cost more money, had worked extensively in Hollywood. Wingo was just trying to break in. At that 11:30 shoot, a few squibs and explosives had been ignited. They weren't as big as what was to come, and Wingo wasn't flying as low either, but they were so powerful that Wingo later said he felt the heat on his face. Here's a newsman relaying what Morrow's unused stunt double said on the stand about that shoot.
The pilot, Dorsey Wingo, screamed out in pain as the heat burned his neck. McLarty says he told director John Landis if the explosions got bigger in the next scene, we'd have a lot of trouble, and Landis agreed to tone down that fatal scene.
The explosions had been so big at the earlier shoot, they had splashed water onto the helicopter's windshield, panicking the pilot for a minute because to one side of the chute was a cliff that he was at risk of flying into if he lost control. Morrow told his girlfriend after that shoot that the stuntmen had shot at him with real bullets and that, quote, had bothered him, end quote. I feel like that has to be an understatement. Landis, for the record, always denied using live ammo, but Trudy Miller, a British model who had been Morrow's live-in girlfriend for a time, wrote in a letter to Alpha Campbell, that's Landis's secretary, that she talked with Vic after the 11:30 shoot and before the 2:21 and he said he had been shot at with real bullets, and Vic had a really bad feeling about the last scene he was about to shoot. Then there were the witnesses who said that just before the helicopter crashed, Landis had been screaming at Wingo through a bullhorn to go lower, lower, lower. Those reports came from assistant cameraman Randy Robinson, who was on the helicopter when it crashed, and also from Melanie Levitt, a makeup artist who'd been on the set. All of this was enough to push Llorente to provide some tips to reporters to make sure the story didn't get spun the way Warner Brothers was trying to spin things, which was this way. They said that James Chamomile, a special effects technician, was the man who had actually detonated the fatal blast, known as Blast Number 4. He was one of five special effects guys, casually called Powdermen, working the scene. Paul Stewart oversaw things, while the others had firing boards that controlled the explosions and squibs and such. Chamomile's board controlled six mortars that had been placed within huts along the waterfront. All of the Powdermen were granted immunity by the prosecution during the grand jury process. Everyone, that is, except Stewart. Prosecutors' thinking was that the jury needed to hear from the Powdermen what exactly had happened in what succession, and that meant ensuring that the story wasn't lost by them taking the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination. Blaming Chamomile, the defense would later make clear, was their fallback position. Someone had to be the trigger man, and might as well be a guy who got immunity. And so the legal machinery began assembling itself on both sides. Landis, initially, was represented by an attorney named Harlan Braun. He was sharp, aggressive, and media savvy, fluent in the language of narrative management. He understood that cases like this were won and lost not just in courtrooms, but in the press, in the framing of facts, in the story that the public told itself before the jury ever assembled. So, he talked to reporters regularly. This, for example, is him describing the footage of the deaths.
The worst thing you could ever see would be three people, and particularly two children, killed right on the film. When you first see it, it's just overwhelming.
The gruesome deaths were recorded on numerous cameras and shown repeatedly at the trial.
And as you watch it over and over again, you become desensitized to it, for good and for ill, I think. I mean, you tend to forget that they're really human beings there, so that's bad. On the other hand, to analyze it as a technical and why it happened, you have to be desensitized to it. And after a while, you looked at it as just a technical thing where we were looking at what caused the accident.
Braun defended Landis vigorously, but Landis's people, and the studio, and the broad network of interests that had aligned around making this problem go away, wanted more. They wanted the best. And in 1980s America, if you were a powerful institution facing serious criminal exposure, and you wanted the best defense money could buy, you called James Neal. Neal was, by any measure, a singular figure. He had won an acquittal for Ford Motor Company in 1980 when it was charged with reckless homicide over the design of its Pinto car. He had successfully defended Louisiana Governor Edwin Edwards in a racketeering trial in 1985. That was the same year Fortune magazine named him one of the country's five best trial lawyers. Before that, he had worked as a prosecutor and had been recruited by Watergate special prosecutor Archibald Cox to investigate the Watergate scandal, and he had served as chief trial counsel in the criminal trial where former Attorney General John Mitchell and presidential aides John Ehrlichman and H.R. Haldeman were convicted. He had sent Teamsters boss Jimmy Hoffa to prison. He had sent Nixon's inner circle to prison. He was, in short, a man who understood exactly how criminal juries thought and what they needed to hear. He also had, by now, a well-documented specialty, taking cases where the facts were terrible for his client and finding the crack in the prosecution's logic through which he could drive a truck. With Ford and the Pinto, that crack had been foreseeability. Could the company have reasonably foreseen that this specific accident would occur? Neil had argued convincingly that it couldn't. Now, facing manslaughter charges arising from a fatal helicopter crash on a movie set, he had a similar angle available. The crash was unforeseeable. No reasonable person could have predicted it. This was a tragedy, not a crime. When Braun was asked to step back from representing Landis directly and take on the representation of George Folsey Jr. instead, it was presented not as a demotion, so much as a reorganization. Folsey, the associate producer, had arguably done the most concrete work of concealing the children's presence, the under-the-table payments, the keeping Jack Tice out of it. Having Braun on his defense was not without strategic value. But the point man, the face of the defense, the man whose southern drawl and courtroom instincts would define the case, was James Neal. And he had his work cut out for him. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Quince Bedding. Okay, summer's here, H is home, we've got vacation mode starting to kick in, and the one thing I've been loving is actually crawling into bed at the end of the day. I recently upgraded our bedding with Quince, and it's made a noticeable difference. Like, I didn't realize how much my old sheets were not doing the job until I switched.
What makes it different are the materials. We're talking 100% European linen woven from high-quality flax, and it literally gets softer every time you wash it. They also have organic cotton sheets, mulberry silk pillowcases, duvet covers in the best summer colors. It feels elevated without being fussy.
And it's not priced like a luxury brand.
That's the whole thing. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than comparable brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not markup. It's the best bedding investment I've made.
Elevate your summer bedding. Go to quince.com/centuries for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/centuries for free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/centuries. While the legal machinery slogged forward, John Landis's life didn't exactly grind to a halt. In December 1983, he directed the groundbreaking video for Thriller, a Michael Jackson song that, back then, wasn't the mere Halloween staple young people probably think of it as today. If you were alive and had access to a television in the 1980s, you watched that thing on repeat on MTV. People memorized the werewolf dance within it. They recited the Vincent Price monologue from memory. Thriller was the most expensive video of its time, with a budget nearing $1 million. Critics called the 14-minute-long miniature movie a masterpiece of horror. They rarely mentioned that one of the director's previous productions left three people dead. Also in 83, Landis directed Trading Places, a smash comedy starring Dan Aykroyd, Eddie Murphy, Ralph Bellamy, and Don Ameche. The latter two were older actors whose careers were jump-started by the hit in the way Morrow had hoped his career would be revived. Ameche hadn't been in a theatrical release since 1970. After Trading Places, he went on to do Cocoon and won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. The year after these two successes, Landis made headlines in the Fresno Bee for a decidedly lower-key accomplishment. In the spring of 1984, a fifth-grade class at Sierra Elementary School in Toll House, California, read about the accident and wrote him letters to cheer him up. One student wrote, "I heard about the accident. I don't think it was your fault. Sometimes you probably wish it didn't happen. Anyway, I think you're great." Another, with the particular earnestness of a 10-year-old, quote, "I hope that you don't go to jail for manslaughter," end quote. That was man, S-L-O-T-T-E-R. Landis wrote back, sent cookies to the class, and invited all 21 students to Universal Studios for a VIP tour and lunch with a real live movie director. I mean, this could have remained a private boost in morale, but the Fresno Bee somehow got word of it and covered it like a feel-good feature, which, of course, it was, because that's how the story was playing in the public imagination. A tragic accident, a great director. Look at him with those kids. What a shame. The trial finally opened on July 23, 1986, exactly 4 years to the day after the deaths. That date was not an accident. Prosecutor Lea D'Agostino had fought for it. D'Agostino was a deputy district attorney in Los Angeles County, and she had been assigned to the case about a year earlier. She was intense, deeply committed to the victims, and under no delusions about what she was up against. She was a single prosecutor, described by the Los Angeles Times as fiery, going up against a team of more than five defense attorneys with significant resources, representing a director whose name was on some of the most commercially successful films of the decade, in a city where the film industry was the industry. She was also convinced, and said so repeatedly without much equivocation, that she was right.
You have to use your own common sense. You cannot mix explosions, a helicopter, and human beings, let alone children, and not realize that there's a potential for danger.
James Neal, Landis's attorney, said of all five defendants,
"Not one of these gentlemen intended to hurt anyone. Not one of these gentlemen thought the scene, as planned and rehearsed, was dangerous. Not one of these gentlemen is guilty of criminal negligence."
Throughout the proceedings, a parade of Hollywood figures made their way to Department 132 of the Criminal Courts Building in Los Angeles. By this point, Landis had directed more high-profile hits. The Three Amigos, starring Steve Martin, Martin Short, and Chevy Chase, and Spies Like Us, with Chase and Dan Aykroyd. He was climbing the ladder as one of Hollywood's highest-profile directors, and many of his supporters were well-known to the jury. Bellamy, one of the stars of Trading Places, came to the trial multiple times. He told reporters outside court that Landis was being persecuted and that there was a theatricality to this. D'Agostino subpoenaed him. Judge Roger Boren quashed it. Aykroyd was another regular attendee.
John's a dear friend and I'm just here to support him in any way I can.
Landis's friend, Eddie Murphy, on the other hand, never attended. This wasn't in Chane's book, but I found it in an interview with Murphy years later in an issue of Playboy. Murphy said he liked Landis. They would work together again in 88 on Coming to America and in 94 on Beverly Hills Cop 3, but he made a conscious choice not to go to the trial, saying, quote, "I don't want to say who was guilty or who was innocent, but if you're directing a movie and two kids get their heads chopped off at 12 o'clock at night when there ain't supposed to be kids working and you said action, then you have some sort of responsibility. So my principals wouldn't let me go down there and sit in court. That's just the way I am," end quote. I'll note too that Chevy Chase didn't come. While shooting Spies, there had been apparently a close shave when Landis insisted on gunfire being used near horses during the filming in Norway, causing the horses to panic and nearly kill a cameraman. Chase supposedly quipped, "I guess it's another John Landis film." So yeah, he wasn't among the courtroom spectators. But plenty of other people were. Carrie Fisher, Jeff Goldblum, Michelle Pfeiffer, Randy Newman. It was probably pretty interesting for jurors, which isn't a bad thing because this trial lasted 10 long months. And getting to play Spot the Celebrity probably helped pass the time. The prosecution's case ran 71 days and called 71 witnesses, parents, crew members, expert pilots, and Hollywood figures, including actor-director Jackie Cooper, not to be confused with former child actor Jackie Coogan. Cooper at this point was chairman of the Directors Guild Safety Committee. He testified that the proximity of the aircraft to the size of the explosions looked very unsafe, and that almost any director he knew and respected, after witnessing the problems in the earlier 11:30 p.m. filming session, quote, would have sent the company home, end quote. But the most devastating testimony came from the parents. Mark Chen, Renee's father, sobbed uncontrollably on the witness stand. George Fulzie, he said, had told him he would treat the children like his own. He said he and his wife had agreed to let their only child be in this movie because it would be something she would look back on with pride after she grew up. Mika's father, Daniel Lee, testified that he heard Landis instructing the helicopter to fly lower. All four parents testified that they had been told there would be no danger, only noise. None realized that the helicopter would be flown so low, nor did they think the explosions would pose any real threat. Harlan Braun said the parents were lying.
They will deny that they knew that there were going to be a helicopter and special effects in a scene which they had seen a similar scene 5 hours before. We just cannot explain that because Mr. Fulzie, in fact, told them all of that.
Their reason for lying? Money, he said. There was a pending civil lawsuit in the case. Other crew members offered additional details. Camera operator Steven Lidecker testified that when he warned Landis the fatal scene looked potentially dangerous, Landis replied with a shrug, quote, "We may lose the helicopter," end quote. Lidecker acknowledged Landis might have been joking, but said he had learned from working with a man not to take anything he said as a joke. Another witness said Landis told a second cameraman who expressed concern that if he didn't want to do the shoot, he could go home and Landis would do it himself. And several crew members recalled Landis joking about the problems in the earlier 11:30 filming sequence, quote, "You ain't seen nothing yet," end quote. D'Agostino took the jury on three field trips, to the crash site at Indian Dunes, to Warner Brothers Studio, and to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, the latter two for viewings of the accident footage from six different camera angles. Jurors repeatedly watched the helicopter spin out of control with no trace of the three actors visible after it came to rest in the river. D'Agostino called Indian Dunes a burial ground. When the prosecutor finally rested her case, she got emotional outside the courtroom, describing it to reporters. The defense case ran just 22 days and called 16 witnesses. Its center of gravity was James Chamomile, who conceded he should have looked at the helicopter before firing each of the special effects explosions he controlled, and that it was his responsibility to ensure his area was clear before firing. That concession was Neil's prize. If Chamomile bore ultimate responsibility for verifying the helicopter's position, the defense argued, then what exactly was Landis supposed to have done differently? It was a coherent argument, and one that conveniently erased everything that had happened before that moment. The illegal hiring, the concealment, the ignored warnings, the "we may lose the helicopter." Though, in looking back at Chamomile's testimony, I realized it actually bolstered the prosecution in a key way.
To your knowledge, sir, was there ever a diagram or schematic made of precisely where the explosions were placed for this final scene?
I don't believe so, no.
And to your knowledge, sir, was there ever a test explosion set off to determine the magnitude of the special explosions that you were present at?
No, not really.
So it wasn't super well planned after all? And that's important because in the end, the case came down to one thing, as this clip from Channel 4 explains.
Could this tragedy have been avoided, or were the events unforeseeable? That is what the Twilight Zone trial will decide.
Foreseeability was the defense's chosen battleground because involuntary manslaughter in California required the prosecution to prove that the defendants had acted with criminal negligence, that they had known, or should have known, that their conduct created a serious danger and had acted with conscious disregard for that danger. Unforeseeable was a legal argument designed to thread the jury through a very specific needle. You can believe everything the prosecution says happened and still not convict if you believe no one could have predicted the outcome. Prosecutors said that despite Landis's insistence the scene had been very carefully planned, the evidence didn't bear that out. The explosives used were far larger than required. People who had complained at 11:30 that that stunt had been too dangerous were ignored. Jack Tice, who would have halted production because of his status as a child welfare officer, was intentionally situated far away from the water scene, so far, in fact, that he testified he assumed dummies were under Vic Morrow's arms. And he had reason to think that. On the call sheets for the 2 days Renee and Mika had been on set, their names never appeared. Instead, the vague description Vietnamese appeared, or on this final night, the letters DBL, short for double, as in stunt double. Tice said he thought that all three of the quote-unquote people in the scenes were either professional stunt actors or, in the case of the kids, possibly dummies. He made that leap not just because of the call sheet, but also because there was no way the scene he saw laid out before him would otherwise be remotely safe. No director in his right mind would shoot that scene with a named star and two young children, would they? Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Storyworth.
Father's Day is coming up fast, June 21st, and if you're still looking for something that isn't going to end up in a drawer, listen to this.
Storyworth is one of my favorite gift ideas for dads because I actually did this for my dad a couple of years ago. Every week, Storyworth sent him a question about his life, his childhood, his memories, things he'd never sit down and tell you on his own, and now I have this beautiful hardcover book of his stories in his own words. I love that book. I learned way more from his childhood and my grandparents thanks to that book than I ever expected.
It's the kind of gift you really can't put a price on.
And it's so easy for him. He can respond by email, voice recording, or even a guided phone call. No apps, no tech hassle. You can pick the questions, write your own, or let Storyworth create personalized ones based on his life. They also just launched an unlimited plan this year. Buy once and give Storyworth to friends and family all year long. I use Storyworth and you should too.
This year, give Dad a gift that captures who he really is before the stories get harder to remember. Father's Day is Sunday, June 21st. Order right now and save up to $20 at storyworth.com/COTC. Save up to $20 at storyworth.com/COTC. storyworth.com/COTC.
Jack Tice wasn't the only man on the Twilight Zone set who thought surely John Landis would never have Vic Morrow and two children run through a fake Vietnamese swamp with a helicopter bearing down on them and huts exploding nearby. Second assistant director Anderson Andy House had also assumed as much. But unlike Tice, he had realized long before the fateful shoot that that's exactly what Landis intended to do. Documents released years after the trial was over, as published in the book Fly By Night, show House tried repeatedly to convince others, including Landis, that it would be far safer to use stunt actors for Morrow and the children, professional little people for the latter, or a stuntman for Morrow and dummies for the children. He raised this concern as early as June, suggesting to unit production manager Dan Allingham that the fiery scenes be shot on a stage to avoid the need for night shoots and, thus, the need to run afoul of child labor laws. Allingham said, no way. Landis was all about realism. He wanted the scene shot at night. He wanted to be able to film Morrow's profile against a firewall of a backdrop, and he wanted the children visible so that it was clear this was a dramatic, impressive scene and not some Hollywood fakery. Okay, House said, we'll shoot at night. But why not use dummies instead of real children? They'll barely be visible anyway. Allingham reportedly said that, quote, the juxtaposition of dummies could never conform to the position that a body would take. It wouldn't work, end quote. It was the kind of phrasing and tone I think we've all heard at work before when we've pushed back on our bosses. It meant, stand down and do your job or we'll find someone else to do it instead. Now, there's no question these children should never have been on set. Landis testified to that much himself. But what about Vic Morrow? This is an interesting question to ponder. Morrow, of course, was an adult and could make his own decisions. He could have said no. But his career was kind of on the line. After years of C-list work, he had been cast in a Spielberg production, and he was working for a guy who didn't take no for an answer. And he was, according to some of the people on set that night, assured that the 11:30 scene had triggered some changes that would make the 2:20 scene safer. But Vic Morrow, talented though he was not a trained stuntman. He was a 53-year-old actor who had been complaining on the down low to allies on the set that he was feeling sick and his gums were killing him. He was so under the weather, in fact, that Landis's own secretary, Alpha Campbell, told him he should have called off sick. But he wanted to power through. This was the last day of filming. Would he have avoided that stumble in the water that cost Morrow and the children a couple of precious seconds? Would he have recognized the sound of a struggling helicopter rotor or sensed the impending danger and just moved faster to make sure things didn't take the awful turn they took? It's, of course, impossible to say. John Landis, for his part, never considered a stuntman. We know this because, to the surprise of many, he took the stand in his defense. It hadn't been a given. Lots of defendants declined to testify in their own defense, and onlookers weren't sure how Landis would fare. And after all, his reputation as an erratic director prone to screaming on the set preceded him. Over 4 days, he calmly admitted breaking California child labor laws by hiring Lee and Chen to work late at night.
We decided to break the law. We decided wrongly to violate the labor code.
He maintained he had never been warned of potential peril in the shooting of the scene, directly contradicting more than a dozen prosecution witnesses, including House, Lydecker, and all four parents. Here's Neil questioning him. Apologies in advance for a slur.
Was there any suggestion of danger in this conversation?
No.
As a matter of fact, John, did anybody ever suggest to you using midgets or dummies in the 220 scene because of danger to children?
No.
Landis said the scene had been carefully planned. Everything was going absolutely as planned. Vic Morrow had been completely on board with doing the stunt. He had insisted on it, in fact. The children had been naturals and knew what to do in the shot. He said he still believed, as he was testifying, that the fatal scene was not inherently dangerous, even though he acknowledged that, as a result of the tragedy, he would never try it again. But he maintained he was absolutely not responsible for any part of it. It had been the Powder Man Chamomile, who happened to have set off his mortar too early before the helicopter made it a safe enough distance away.
The helicopter really just startled me. I was like, what? And then, yes, I became aware. I was, oh my God, where's Vic and Meek and Renee? And I ran to them, yes.
During parts of his testimony, he teared up and wiped his eyes. D'Agostino said afterward,
it's a perfectly orchestrated, choreographed script. Just the right amount of hesitancy, just the right amount of looking down, the right amount of looking at the jury, the right amount of smiling when a smile was necessary. It's extremely well done. I frankly wish I had an Oscar that I could give him for his performance.
James Neal took offense to D'Agostino's characterization of Landis's testimony performance.
Faking his emotion? I thought on the contrary. I think he tried not to show any emotion.
It wouldn't be the only time the two attorneys disagreed. Throughout its lengthy run, the Twilight Zone trial had been quite the spectacle, and not just because of the Hollywood names attached to it. The lawyers themselves whipped up plenty of headlines. There was no gag order, so all the attorneys, the prosecution, and five of the main defense attorneys often talked to reporters in the hallways before and after court and during breaks, hurling insults every which way. Harlan Braun, now representing Folsy, called D'Agostino scum. She retorted that Braun would call his own mother a liar if it would help him win. Paul Stewart's attorney, Arnold Klein, told reporters that D'Agostino had the IQ of a radish. She gave as good as she got, both in and out of the courtroom. Here's reporter Paul Dandridge describing one back and forth.
At one point this morning, he broke down on the stand, cried, as his attorney, Jim Neal, took him to that moment that he has not talked about publicly in 4.5 years, when Vic Morrow, Mika Lee, and Renee Chen were killed in the tragic accident at Indian Dunes, Twilight Zone, the movie. The prosecutor, when it was her turn to ask Landis a question, mockingly asked him, "Do you want a Kleenex?" An apparent attempt to tell the jury that this man was not being sincere. She also asked him if he was a good storyteller, knew how to make himself and other people cry on the stand.
It was all pretty brutal. Looking back at the coverage, I'd say reporters gave some deference to the defense's side of things, maybe in part because there were just more of them. If you're two-sidesing a story and one side has five voices to the other side's one, well, things can end up lopsided. In fairness, I do think some sexism was mixed in as well. I mean, I could see that in Stephen Chain's book, in fact. The author spent long passages critiquing her appearance and called her bird-like no fewer than 5 times. Then, listen to this contemporary news coverage from the time.
Inside the courtroom, the two sides argue over legal matters. But outside, the arguments become much more petty.
I don't admire Mrs. DeAugustino. And there's no way I'd ever like Mrs. DeAugustino.
It's her one big case. She loves it. She enjoys it. She dresses for the occasion.
DeAugustino doesn't mind being called a clothes horse. She even admitted to one reporter that her wardrobe is so large that she doesn't repeat an outfit in 2 months. But she resents her opponent's accusations that she's using this case for personal gain. DeAugustino says she doesn't need the money. Her husband has plenty of it.
Anyway, Landis was one of just 2 defendants to testify in the trial. Dorsey Wingo, the pilot of the Huey that fell, also took the stand. What jurors and the general public didn't know at the time was that behind the scenes, Wingo had long been at odds with Landis, who initially had blamed the pilot for the accident. Landis had claimed to the NTSB investigators that Wingo had flown the chopper far lower than he was instructed to, that the Huey was actually never supposed to be seen in the shot at all, in fact. Never mind that multiple witnesses testified to hearing Landis both motion for the chopper to come lower and audibly yell "lower, lower" through a bullhorn just before the accident. But once Wingo was on the stand, his story had changed. While he earlier had said there had never been a proper rehearsal of the scene, he now testified that they had run through it carefully at 2 a.m., just minutes before the shoot. According to Chain, the 5 defense lawyers had actually flagged this inconsistency in an internal memo shared only amongst themselves titled "Prior Statements of Dorsey Wingo Which May Be Difficult to Overcome." It was 12 pages long and underscored things like Wingo had told investigators he had been kept in the dark about the placement of the explosives he was to fly over, and that when he had complained that the 11:30 shoot was too intense, Landis had chided, "Don't be squeamish," and that he had been assured that the 2:20 shoot would be safer than the 11:30, but it was, in fact, far worse. Wingo's testimony contradicted all of this. The jury didn't know that in the interim, John Landis had started inviting Wingo and his wife to hang out and gave him gifts for his newborn baby and such. DeAugustino tried to highlight these inconsistencies and others for the jury, and she pointed out 19 times that Landis's testimony contradicted other witnesses' testimony. She told reporters,
"The whole world is lying according to John Landis, except John Landis. I find that somewhat incredible, and I'm assuming that the jurors will too."
But after 10 long months, all that back and forth testimony became an indecipherable mess for the jury. Once both sides gave days-long closing statements, they began their 9-day deliberation. Most of that time was spent on rereading testimony, trying to make sense of things they'd heard months earlier in some cases. The day before the verdict, they requested to view the accident footage one more time in the jury room. When they finally voted, it took only one round of balloting. On May 29th, 1987, the verdicts came back.
Title of court and cause. We, the jury, in the above-entitled action, find the defendant, John Landis, not guilty of involuntary manslaughter as charged in count one of the amended information.
The same went for every defendant. Jury forewoman Lois Rogers held a courtroom press conference from the jury box. She said, quote, "We believe this was all an unforeseeable accident. You don't prosecute people for unforeseeable accidents," end quote. The jurors hugged and shook hands with the defendants afterward. It was a devastating defeat for D'Agostino.
"I'm shocked. I'm appalled. I'm disappointed because I believe that the conduct clearly was, as I said before, I don't want to sound repetitious, was about as reckless as it can get."
The defendants, none of whom had spoken much with the press directly, broke their silence. Pilot Dorsey Wingo.
"Well, it's just a wonderful time, and I wish we could get the jurors close for a minute. I want to kiss at least half of them and hug the rest. We're just astounded, and we're very grateful."
Associate producer George Folsey.
"I'm very grateful for all of the defendants, and I want to thank my wife for all her wonderful support and all my friends, and especially the attorneys who spend so much time staying with us and helping us."
And of course, John Landis, who had dabbed his eyes with a handkerchief as the verdicts were read.
"You know, our being found not guilty doesn't change the tragedy. It doesn't change the accident. I've learned that the concept of an accident is terrifying to people. And there must be somebody's fault. And as a participant in an accident, being there, no, I don't see the trial and their deaths the same. And I mean, regardless of the trial, there's still the terrible tragedy."
D'Agostino agreed. The tragedy remained. And so did many in Hollywood. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by ButcherBox. Grilling season is here, and my neighbor Sean is always on the back porch grilling like the grill master he is. I'm wanting to match that energy and step up our game on our cookout attempts.
That's where ButcherBox comes in. It's changed how we stock our kitchen. It just shows up, we throw it in the freezer, and we'll always be ready.
It's amazing, and it's customizable. Over 100 premium protein options. Grass-fed beef, wild-caught seafood, chicken. It's all sourced responsibly. No antibiotics, no added hormones, no fillers. You can just feel good about what you're serving.
During grilling season especially, that quality really shows up on the plate.
100%. Better meat means better flavor, and honestly, fewer mistakes on the grill. Plus, everything ships free, and you get recipes and grilling tips included. Whether you're a beginner or a grill master, you've got what you need.
As an exclusive offer, new listeners can get their choice between free sirloin tips, ground beef, or chicken wings in every box for life, plus $20 off when you go to butcherbox.com/COTC. That's right. Your choice of free sirloin tips, ground beef, or chicken wings in every box for life, plus $20 off your first box and free shipping always. That's butcherbox.com/COTC. Don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you.
A year after the five defendants in the Twilight Zone case celebrated their acquittals, the Los Angeles Times checked in with key players and reported in an in-depth piece that the ordeal had cast more of a shadow over some of their lives than others. John Landis had continued working. Coming to America made $100 million in under 2 months, one of the most lucrative openings in film history at that time. Shortly before production began, he and his wife Deborah had purchased Rock Hudson's former Beverly Hills estate for close to $3 million. Though his friendship with Steven Spielberg ended, Spielberg has publicly said that came in the aftermath of the deaths, Landis was doing fine by any measure Hollywood used to keep score. The men who tried to hold the industry accountable were not. Steven Lidecker had been one of the first crew members to blow the whistle, a 26-year veteran of the film business whose grandfather and father had both been respected Hollywood craftsmen. He had warned Landis before the fatal take that the explosives could endanger the helicopter. A week after the accident, he helped convene a press conference at his home to publicly decry what he and fellow cameramen saw as a cavalier disregard for human safety at Indian Dunes. By August 1988, 6 years after the crash, he had not received a single job offer in the industry. When he asked a friend to help him get hired for a minimal number of hours, just enough to maintain his union health and welfare benefits, the reply came back that his name had been placed in a hat as a troublemaker. The producers and production managers, he was told, just didn't want to deal with him. He said, quote, "I didn't think it would be the rest of my life, but it looks like that's the way it's going to be," end quote. Roger Smith, who had been filming Vic Morrow and the two children from aboard the helicopter, suffered serious neck and back injuries when the aircraft plummeted into the shallow river. He had been a union cameraman since 1958. After going public, he found himself largely locked out of studio work, forced into commercials and non-union jobs. Randall Robinson, the camera assistant who had also participated in the press conference, spent 9 months unable to find any work at all. He was eventually diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and continued having nightmares about the accident. He said, quote, "The industry saw us as three big lugs shooting our mouths off," end quote. And then there was Dorsey Wingo, the helicopter pilot who had flown dozens of combat missions in Vietnam, who had taken the Twilight Zone job in part because he wanted to be able to afford to support his wife's family in Mexico, found his friendship with Landis was short-lived. He said he had spent 5 years as probably the most famous helicopter pilot in the country, not in a good way. After the verdict, the FAA moved to revoke his license. His professional future remained under a cloud through years of appeals. When a reporter visited Wingo at the Western Helicopter Company in Rialto a year after the verdicts, flying was still his livelihood, but it was no longer quite the same life. He said, quote, "15 minutes of fame would have been more than enough for me," end quote. Meanwhile, one figure managed to avoid accountability entirely. Frank Marshall, executive producer of Twilight Zone the movie, partner to Steven Spielberg, a man who had been on the scene at the time of the accident, and who, by multiple accounts from witnesses, had known well in advance that Mika Lee and Renee Chen had been hired and paid illegally, was never interviewed by the Sheriff's Department, the NTSB, the District Attorney's Office, or any other accountability agency. A sheriff's investigator named Thomas Buds had tried repeatedly to reach Marshall at Universal and Warner Brothers and was told each time that Marshall was unavailable. When the DA finally sent Buds to London to serve Marshall with an international subpoena compelling him to testify, Marshall refused to meet with the U.S. Embassy representative who arrived at the St. James Club and then left London on a private jet belonging to Spielberg's Amblin Entertainment, bound for Paris. He never answered a single question about the case. In fact, the Los Angeles Times piece ends with this amazing kicker. Quote, "Marshall's office was contacted in connection with this article, but declined to comment. His assistant said that Marshall was out of the country," end quote. His career as Spielberg's producing partner, which would go on to encompass Who Framed Roger Rabbit, the Indiana Jones films, the Jason Bourne franchise, and decades of major studio productions, was never disrupted by what had happened at Indian Dunes. On the industry change side, the accounting is complicated. Warner Brothers set up dedicated safety committees to establish standards for every aspect of filmmaking, from gunfire to fixed-wing aircraft to smoke and pyrotechnics. The standards were regularly issued as safety bulletins and published as what became the Injury and Illness Prevention Program Safety Manual for Television and Feature Production. The Directors Guild of America established a telephone hotline for directors with safety questions and began publishing safety bulletins for members. The Screen Actors Guild drafted new contract clauses allowing actors to leave sets where they felt unsafe and introduced a 24-hour hotline for anonymous reporting. In 1987, the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection formed the Motion Picture and Entertainment Safety Program to oversee the use of pyrotechnics on film and television sets. And these were real changes. They were, in some cases, substantial. A 1987 Christian Science Monitor report found that on-set accidents had fallen sharply in the years following the tragedy. And whether you attribute that to the tragedy itself, to the trial, or to the industry's fear of bad publicity, when studio producers said bluntly that Hollywood responds more to bad publicity than to verdicts, the reforms happened, and they mattered. Granted, most of the changes came from the bottom up, from insurers, the guilds, the state, rather than from any reckoning within the industry itself. Steve Lerner, the director of photography on Twilight Zone, argued for new rules to govern the use of dangerous stunts.
If this doesn't happen, then I think we should withhold our services until this is put into place. I don't see how we can continue on this way. This must stop.
Richard Zradnick of The Hollywood Reporter said that in the wake of the disaster,
the state of California really strengthens, made stricter those regulations dealing with children in movies. In particular, how close a child can get to a dangerous situation, you know, whirling blades or explosions, things like that. The other big impact was the Directors Guild of America, which is the directors union here in the States, has set up a safety committee that I've been told is partly a response to what happened in this film, and the committee's looking at safety on the set, safety during a film production.
Filmmaking is still a dangerous business, of course. There are too many examples to name them all. A consultant was killed in the making of Top Gun. Actor Brandon Lee was fatally shot during a scene in The Crow. The 2021 shooting death of cinematographer Helena Hutchins on the set of Rust. But in general, there's a more robust system in place than there had been before the Twilight Zone tragedy. As for the families of Mika Lee and Renee Chen, they had already been accused from the witness stand of fabricating their accounts for financial gain. They were spared a repeat of that in a civil courtroom, settling their wrongful death case just before the criminal verdicts came in, reportedly splitting $4 million between the two families. It was a lot of money, but it, of course, couldn't fix a thing. The children, by the way, are not in the final cut of the movie. It ends the same way it had before Lucy Fisher of Warner Brothers made the fateful suggestion of softening the character Vic Morrow played. Bill Connor finds himself in a jungle river with American soldiers opening fire on him despite his protestations that he too is American. A lobbed grenade blows him from the water back to Nazi Germany, where he's tossed into a rail car, a Star of David pinned to his chest. He reaches through the wooden slats, screaming for help. Fade to black. To research this case, I spent hours watching contemporary news coverage of the trial and reading archive newspaper stories. I also read Stephen Chain's Fly By Night, which featured never-before-publicized information and documents whose sourcing Chain does not disclose, though defense lawyer Harlan Braun's endorsement of the book appears prominently on its cover. I learned from the Santa Fe New Mexican that Chain's a former journalist who had attended every day of the trial, with intentions of writing a book, but set it aside until 2022, publishing it at age 70. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're @centuriespod. And you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.